Raghava is going to take us through.
Thank you, Ian. This paper picks up issues raised in few submissions about enforceable rights and obligations. Stakeholders question whether paragraphs 11 and 12 of IFRS 15 are clear in evaluating termination clauses and determining the duration of the contract, and specifically whether the specified duration of a contract should be restricted to reflect the expected termination date if each party to the contract has a unilateral enforceable right to terminate the contract. Some stakeholders think that in determining the duration for which parties have present enforceable rights and obligations, the standard does not explicitly explain how termination penalties should be considered. However, those stakeholders think that the guidance in the standard, along with the explanations and the basis for conclusions, would lead an entity to conclude that a contract continues to exist for the specified contractual period even if each party to the contract has the unilateral enforceable right to terminate the contract at any time during the specified contractual period by compensating the other party. The guidance refers to whether the termination requires compensating the other party. Now, some stakeholders have shared a narrow interpretation of this guidance, asserting that the guidance refers only to termination penalties, while other stakeholders take a broader view that compensating the other party is any amount related to something other than payments due as a result of goods delivered or services transferred up to the termination date, and therefore it is not restricted only to payments explicitly characterized as termination penalties. Considering the overall guidance, stakeholders think that an entity would be able to identify the duration of the contract. Some stakeholders noted that there are consequences if an entity concludes that the contractual period is less than the stated term of the contract because of termination clauses, as explained in paragraph 12 of this paper. Some stakeholders also observed that recognition of revenue based on an assumption of termination is inconsistent with the contract position, because the contract position is likely to be a contract asset, which means that the entity has future performance obligations. Over to you for the comments.
Okay, any comments here? We have some comments.
I think we were generally comfortable with the direction of the analysis in the paper, and I think there's enough guidance in the standard and the basis for us to work with to get to sensible conclusions.
Anybody got a contrary view? London. No? So over to you, Jim.
Is it going to be that straightforward in the U.S.? Allison.
The only question that comes up, it's just not mentioned in example three. So this is the one where the entity enters into a contract with a customer to provide services for 2 years. Either party can terminate the contract by compensating the other party. Just the way that it's very simply stated, it seems to automatically say that just because there's a termination penalty in the contract, that that makes the 2 year period enforceable. And I guess the question, or what's missing from this analysis, is the I guess the likelihood or the incentive for both parties to continue to perform in light of the termination penalty. And I guess in kind of building that out a little bit, I think there's a paragraph in the basis 391 that talks about a 24-month contract with a cancellation option is economically similar to a 12-month contract with renewal periods available. And then if we had that latter situation where you had a 12-month contract with renewals, we'd have to go through an evaluation to figure out if there was a material right present in the arrangement that would suggest there are additional performance obligations and thus an extension of the contract term. You would think that a similar analysis would apply on the inverse, meaning that if you have a 24-month period but there's a cancellation penalty, you'd need to think about whether there's a disincentive for both parties to terminate the contract, meaning that therefore you then have a 2-year arrangement. And maybe it's just because the example is sort of simply stated, but it wasn't clear whether that's supposed to factor into the analysis or not, at least the way that it's described here.
For example, if the termination penalty was a dollar or a euro, then maybe the existence of the penalty doesn't create the longer contract.
Exactly. One would like to think that something that obviously non-substantive would get flagged, but what if it's not a dollar? What if it's some lower percentage of the contract value? I mean, there's judgment that gets factored in, and I think that you would need to incorporate that judgment into your analysis versus, again, the example here. And maybe it's just it needed to be simply stated for a reason, but it doesn't seem to suggest that that's part of the analysis.
Yeah, I think this is coming up a lot more lately. I the way the paper's laid out, I think the examples seem to be pretty clear cut. Maybe that's why you're not getting. But we're seeing it in the telco space. What is their contract period? If they let people upgrade at certain periods, is it without penalty? And is it a 21-month contract? Is it 24-month contract? We see it in parts suppliers where they'll sign a master service agreement, maybe for three, it's stated period of 3 years to supply parts to a particular OEM, and there's no committed purchases. So every month or every periodically, they get, here's the parts that we need, send them to us. There might be upfront tooling or something that's involved in that you provide to the customer, and what is the contract period that they're supposed to assess? And allocate consideration to. So they don't, they know what they think the OEM's going to order, and they know the OEM's going to order something because they need it, but there's no committed purchases. So if there is something up front provided, like I think in the automotive industry they provide tooling, the tooling's separate, the customer owns it, and say that up front they get maybe a fixed amount or they don't get anything, and that then they're going to recover it through the piece price. Is the contract period only the first purchase order they get with that order, and that's what they allocate to the tooling, or is it the 3 years expected amount of parts that they're going to get that they're going to allocate to that tooling? We're struggling with figuring out what the contract period is in that situation. And then in the asset manager's situation where they have 5 or 10 year funds that they're going to that they have the consideration is contingent, and they have specific termination rights each quarter, each period. How should they consider those? Is the contract the whole 10 years that the fund's expected to run, or is it just the point at which they can terminate? And how do they evaluate that? If they can terminate, do they have to have both parties to terminate? How should they evaluate those? So I think it's coming up a lot more in trying to figure that out. So.
So do people think that the standard gives you the tools to make those evaluations? In London, we heard
yes.
Scott?
I think the standard does give us the tools that address one that Mark just brought up, the automotive supplier. While those contracts typically don't have any minimums, they do say that everything the OEM needs has to be purchased from this supplier. So I wouldn't have thought that was a contract that could be terminated without penalty because the OEM can't go buy it from someone else. So, there I'd have evaluated that to say it's a three-year contract. Quantity is not fixed, but it is a three-year contract because they can't go buy from somebody else and terminate the contract.
They can terminate and just not buy anything else.
Yeah, but the contract is still in place in that it still binds them to buy whatever they need of that part from this supplier. So I wouldn't have thought that was a contract that was terminated. It's still in place. The restrictions still apply. So I wouldn't have said that that's a zero-day contract. I'd have said it's a three-year contract, but the quantity is varying.
There's people that differ with that. So
I'm surprised.
Definitely in Detroit.
Well, I got to go back to Detroit. I answered these questions nonstop for 10 years.
So I guess, Scott, in that situation, you would say estimate how many units they're going to get and allocate based on that and then reallocate every...
Right. To the question of the term of the contract, in your example, I just said it's a three-year contract. It's just the quantity that you need to estimate.
Could I just ask whether the new standard has changed anything, because these problems must have been in existence forever and decisions have been made up to date.
Now with the contingent consideration lifted and that you would allocate to any upfront deliverable, I think it calls into it, you end up with, you've got to figure out if you give the tooling away, and that my example for free, and you expect to recover it in the piece price, now I would think that you would have to look at the contract period, determine the transaction price, and allocate to that tooling, and then apply the constraint, what you've done. So, and then I guess every time the estimate of the parts changes, you would have to reallocate it to it. And then in the case of the asset managers, the guidance, well, we don't know whether the guidance on D96 is going to go away in the U.S., but if it does, you know, it definitely is going to impact them depending on how you evaluate the termination provisions. Are they entitled to what they've earned to date, or the amount that they're entitled to if it's terminated? Can they recognize that, or do they have to wait till the very end of the fund and recognize until they recognize any revenue? So I think it is very important now, especially with some of the guidance that's been superseded.
Jim, I've got some overall comments I might want to make when we're done with this issue, so I'll pause until we're done with this, but I'd like to say a couple.
Okay, Jim, do you want me to sum up on this one?
Sure.
Well, I think with the paper we had, there was general agreement on how these things should be issued, except Alison's timely warning. I think that you need to take into account the likelihoods and the incentives and things as well. So maybe the examples were a little bit deliberately simplistic and there's a little bit more to it. And then, of course, we've had the other warning that there may well be some other problems arising and we may hear more about this. But I think on the basis of this paper and this discussion, I think the overall conclusion is that for what we have here, the standard deals with it adequately. I don't know if anybody disagrees with that conclusion. Okay, well, that being the case, I heard that there might be some general comments. Has anybody in London got some general comments before I turn it back to Jim? Okay, Jim.
Jay, and I know we had Russell also, I think, he missed the when we talked about the summary of last time's issues, but Jay, go ahead.
Thanks, Jim. So I'm a PCAOB board member, one of five, and I can only speak for myself, not my fellow board, but just want to make some overarching comments about some of the things I've heard, and appreciate all the debate about some of these issues, and I heard a number of things today where reasonable people could walk away with different conclusions on how to apply, and I undertone of some of the discussion, I think, is, all the second-guessing that's going to come as a result of decisions that are made where reasonable people might disagree, and the second-guessing preparers will come from the SEC and their auditors, from the auditors will come from us and the SEC and others. I just want to observe that when we go to do an inspection of the work of an audit in any given company, we usually do look at revenue. And in the inspection reports that have just been issued for the 2013 inspection cycle, so last the U.S. Big Four reports are out now, and of the 200-plus engagements we looked at, I think we had exactly zero restatements that arose as a result of our inspection activities last year. I might have that off by one, but very few to none. And anytime we do have a significant gap application issue where it's not just clear that the gap was wrong, we consult initially informally with the SEC and then more formally, and oftentimes I understand the firm will nudge their client to go have a discussion too to make sure that all the points are on the table. And so the one thing we do look at in virtually every engagement we inspect, though, is the auditors work on the controls around it. And so many things here, and I appreciate the difficulties. Alan, you talked about 30,000 individual contracts to look at with the exact same language, or you might reach different conclusions. I appreciate that will be incredible difficulty, and just encourage you to think about what controls you need to have in place beyond what you have today. And I appreciate, and today you deal with similar issues also, so we will certainly be looking at that very carefully, and the reasoned judgments that are well documented, where the auditor has been objective and skeptical and considered the contrary information, those are easier to conclude on versus ones where we don't understand how you got there, and most of the findings are about how you got there. Since we met last, we have issued, Marty and his team issued a staff practice alert on all the things we're seeing in the inspections we do relative to auditing revenue and across all the sizes of companies and firms, based on existing GAAP, existing auditing standards, and that does a really good job of summarizing all the things that we see, and there's a lot of blocking and tackling there, a lot around the controls, but then a lot around how much, how deep the auditor go in testing the revenue with the number of transactions, et cetera, as well as did they look at the GAAP. And so we are very mindful of our standards and whether we need to think about changing some of our standards. We have informally, I'm not sure if it's on our standard setting agenda yet, but at least we're looking at it and collecting information, including these meetings. So appreciate all the discussion.
And Russell, I think you had an observation on the summary from last time.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Appreciating that it's Friday afternoon and it's late in London. I'll make this quick. So the summary on summarizing the July TRG meeting where we talked about gross versus net and the sales tax question, appreciating that the summary is a good summary of our discussion, but when staring at the jurisdiction by jurisdiction words that were written down, it sort of started to sink in that the reality of that is it would be a real challenge from an implementation standpoint for a lot of companies. I went back and talked to some people that were part of the EITF process and were part of EITF 06-3, and I went back and looked at the minutes and the issue summaries. Is it worth considering maybe as a practical expedient something similar to 06-3, given the practical implications of doing that analysis on a jurisdiction by jurisdiction basis?
So Russell had told me how many jurisdictions you had to evaluate. It was a little stark, 20,000.
So it was rough estimate, give or take 1,000, but yeah, 20,000 or so jurisdictions.
I think that's useful input for us to know. Ian, send it over to you for any concluding comments.
Yeah, well, I mean, firstly, Jim, I'd say whoever allocated the topics between you and me should do the job again next time, because I got this one.
Yeah, just reverse the...
I think that's been a good discussion, and it's our second meeting. We're moving on. I think actually we were more efficient than our first meeting, and we've got improvements to make, and we encourage all the members to let us know what they think we should be doing differently and how we should be moving forward. As somebody said earlier, we've got a timetable for next year set out. We'll draft the report again, and we're always ready to take comments on how that report should be formatted, but I think we've got to a reasonable compromise given that the sessions are fully recorded and on our websites. We're still working together. We've still got a converged standard, and we've got to keep really endeavouring to keep it that way. So thanks very much, and to everybody on both sides. We're not going to be late for dinner, and you're not going to be late for lunch, as long as Jim doesn't speak too much. Yeah, that's fine. Thanks, Jim.
Great. Thank you. And thanks again for the participation. It really is useful to us to hear the dialogue. I think that the discussion today has focused on a couple areas that the staff will, I'm sure, want to circle back with the board. I think one of those issues obviously builds upon the licenses issue from last time. Hopefully we'll be able to isolate a few issues and be more definitive about next steps, what, if anything, the boards might be doing. So don't feel like this is just a discussion that is an intellectual one. We really do hear the challenges in a couple of areas that you're facing. So thank you again, and get 5 minutes back in your